Hey guys, it's Ryan. I want to tell you about my new pastime, Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has been around for over a decade, delivering the most fun you can have online. Play social casino style games for free anytime, anywhere. So sign up at chumbacasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 21 plus.
This week, juries reached verdicts, high-profile trials got underway, a nationally known true crime podcaster found herself on the receiving end of a judge's ruling, and investigators released new evidence in the mysterious death of 18-year-old Nolan Wells. Let's get you caught up on everything happening inside the courtroom. This is the 13th Juror Podcast, where we explore the trials, investigations, and true crime stories that everyone is talking about. I'm your host, Brandi Churchwell, and this is Court Report, your weekly roundup of the biggest courtroom headlines, breaking stories, and the legal developments shaping the nation's most talked about cases. First, let's start this week with a verdict that came down just yesterday in New Mexico. Now, last week, we told you about the trial of Isaac Apodaca out of New Mexico. It's a truly bizarre and disturbing murder case. According to the state, Isaac manipulated his then-girlfriend, Kiera, into killing 21-year-old Grace Jennings with a sword. Now, Grace had dated both Kiera and Isaac in the past. Now, she was underage when she dated Isaac, who was 20 at the time. Fast forward 10 years, and Grace is going through a breakup, so Isaac invited Grace to come stay at his home with him and Kiera McCulley, his girlfriend, who, remember, had also previously dated Grace, even before Isaac. Now, prosecutors alleged that while Isaac never actually wielded the weapon, he was the mastermind behind this killing. So according to the state, he manipulated and psychologically coerced his girlfriend, Kiera, into killing Grace with a 36-inch sword inside the detached garage where they were living. Now, the prosecution relied heavily on text messages that they say showed Isaac encouraging and directing the killing, while the defense argued that Kiera acted on her own and was now just blaming Isaac to secure a favorable plea deal for herself. Now, this trial was interesting because they relied heavily on Kiera's testimony, where she detailed the planning and execution of the murder. Kiera said on the stand that Isaac basically pimped her out and wanted her to make them some money through prostitution. So he would set up dates for her and she would give the money to him. But then things took an even wilder turn. Kiera said that Isaac told her that he was the Archangel Gabriel and he was part of a group called Ghost that was basically like a vigilante group, and he had already killed 40 people before. And he said that he had seen a video where Grace, the victim, had facilitated the gang rape of Kiera and that Grace was paid for facilitating this. Okay, so this all sounds really out there, right? But this was all part of the manipulation that the prosecution introduced to show how Isaac coerced Kiera into killing Grace. Now, Kiera said she had never seen that video herself of herself apparently going through this, but she said she believed that this really happened. Now, eventually, a part of her did want Grace dead, and she said that she really just wanted to do it to get it over with so that Isaac would stop pressuring her. Here she is on the stand going over the details of when it happened.
Isaac handed me the sword.
Okay. What did you take that to mean?
I mean, it's time to do it, and I had no choice.
At that point, how were you feeling emotionally?
Overwhelmed.
What happened next?
He told me he would hurt my mom if I didn't do it. Because I was standing there like, what the fuck are you trying to make me do?
Okay. Then what happened?
Then Grace started laughing at me like it was some big joke.
How'd that make you feel?
It brought all of my anger out in one spot.
What happened next?
I closed my eyes and swung the sword.
When you made that first swing, where was Isaac?
He was right next to her, on her right.
When you swung the first time, what did Isaac do?
And he got up and he started saying, "Come on, finish it, finish it, finish it."
Crazy, right? So the state also showed hundreds of text messages and social media messages between Kiara and Isaac. And the messages are chilling, especially after knowing everything that happened. Isaac is telling Kiara that they need to use a dagger because it's blunt. And Kiara asks why blunt is better. And Isaac said it's because it cuts like butter. And then Kiara is asking details about what happens and how they clean it up and how to go through with it. And Isaac tells her it'll be instant, and he explains that they will just clean up the mess by burning it. And y'all, this is the part that kind of got me. This was really crazy. He says something about how they'll just buy new blankets and a new bed. And Kiara said that she loves those sheets and her favorite fuzzy blanket is there. That is chilling to me. It's so matter of fact the way they're talking about murdering this girl. Now, after hearing 6 days of testimony, jurors deliberated for less than 2 hours before returning guilty verdicts on first degree murder and conspiracy to commit first degree murder. So Isaac Apodaca now faces a mandatory life sentence. And Kiara, in exchange for her testimony, took a plea deal. So she pleaded guilty to aggravated second degree murder and conspiracy to commit murder with a sentence of 30 years in prison. There was also another high-profile verdict that came down this week. The jury reached a verdict in the civil case involving Florida State Representative Fabian Basabe. He was accused of sexual harassment, battery, and defamation. Now, the lawsuit was brought by two men who had worked around Fabian at the Florida Capitol. Former legislative aide Nicholas Frivola alleged that Basabe slapped him on the butt without his consent during an elementary school career day in December of 2022, which, what a time to do something like that. And then about a month later, Frivola claimed that Basabe slapped him across the face at a private event and told him to go stand in the corner. There's also an intern, Jacob Cutbirth, who also testified that Basabe tried to kiss him and made repeated unwelcome sexual comments. Now, the Florida House investigated the allegations at the time, but ultimately said that the findings were inconclusive. Afterward, though, Basabe took to social media and he called Nicholas and his mother a, quote, conning, scheming mother and son duo, end quote, and accused them of making false allegations. He referred to them as lazy, entitled, unscrupulous, self-involved, ungrateful, lying scum. Those are his exact words. And he didn't back away from those comments during trial. In fact, while testifying, Basabe told jurors that Nicholas was always a loser. Now, one of the most emotional moments of the trial came when Nicholas's mother took the stand, and she broke down in tears while she was describing what the ordeal had done to her son and their family. And the testimony became so emotional that the judge actually sent the jury out of the courtroom to give her time to compose herself. And at that time, Nicholas actually went up to the stand and was trying to comfort her and calm her down. Now, Basabe chose to represent himself during the trial. And y'all, we have seen that time and time again. That is usually a very risky decision. Throughout the proceedings, the judge repeatedly reprimanded him for violating court orders. And at one point, the judge even told him, "This is not an election. This is a court of law," criticizing him for turning the trial into a political spectacle and warning him that his conduct had improperly tainted the proceedings. Now, after about 2 hours of deliberations, the jury found Basabe liable for sexual harassment and defamation, awarding a total of $450,000 in damages. We'll be right back.
Bubba Wallace here from 2311 Racing. You know what's slower than a pace car? Waiting at the car wash. That's when I fire up Chumba Casino. It turns those slow minutes into fast fun. With new games every week, you'll never get bored. Next time you're stuck in the slow lane, speed up with Chumba. Play now at ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
Sponsored by Chumba Casino. No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
Okay, y'all, let's move on to some new charges. Now, I have a really disturbing story coming out of my neck of the woods this morning, not far from me here in Panama City Beach. Now, if you're from the 850, you may remember seeing the missing person alerts for 43-year-old Jason Coulthard from Niceville. Now, Jason, who friends know as Jersey, was a father who disappeared at the end of May after he was last seen leaving the college condominiums on East College Boulevard. For weeks, his family searched desperately for answers. Then, on June 25th, investigators received information that Jason's body had allegedly been buried on a property on Sunset Lane in Freeport. Now, because the property is in Walton County, Niceville police contacted the Walton County Sheriff's Office, who obtained a search warrant that same day. When investigators searched the property, they found a shallow grave. Jason's remains have now been positively identified through DNA. Now, it's an absolutely heartbreaking outcome for his family. But now we're learning what investigators believe happened, and the allegations are shocking. I have spent some time digging through police reports, and here's what I've pieced together. So according to investigators, on June 25th, the two independent witnesses came forward about what had happened, and they both pointed toward 38-year-old Isabel Johnson as responsible for Jason's murder. Now, Isabel lived on the property on Sunset Lane in Freeport with her roommates, Bobby Wagstaff and James Teal. Now, Teal suffers from terminal cancer, and he told investigators that he had been afraid to come forward because he feared retaliation. But he said he decided to tell police everything because, in his words, he was going to die soon anyway. Now, according to Teal, Isabel had previously told him about killing a man that they called Jersey, which investigators believed was Jason Coulthard. Teal said that Isabel and their other roommate, Bobby, had dug the grave on their property near a shed. He told detectives that he never actually saw Jason's body, but he knew that the hole was dug intended for him. Now, after the hole was filled, Isabel parked a car over it to conceal it, and then she left town and went to Georgia. The other witness was Isabel's boyfriend, Matthew Sweeney, who told detectives that he and Isabel were in Georgia on June 2nd when Isabel received a phone call from her roommate, Bobby, that had helped her dig the grave. Now, according to Sweeney, Bobby told Isabel that a dog had dug up Jason's body and she needed to return to Florida to help clean everything up. So Sweeney said that Isabel had another friend drive her back to Freeport, Florida. And about a day and a half later, she returned to Georgia. When she got back, Sweeney said that Isabel confessed to killing Jason and burying him on the property. Isabel told him that she used a zip tie around Jason's neck and then buried him in the yard and then parked a black Cadillac over the grave to hide it. Now, after the dog disturbed the burial site, she told him that she poured concrete over the area so that the dog could not dig there again. Isabel claimed that she killed Jason because he was abusive and was coercing her into criminal activity and wanted more from their relationship. That's her story. So investigators got these two tips, and when they went to search the property, they found Jason's body buried beneath freshly poured concrete. Now, reports noted that there was actually still live grass underneath the concrete, which suggested that it had obviously been poured recently. So investigators also recovered a white zip tie around Jason's neck, and similar zip ties were found inside the residence. And also Jason's credit cards were recovered from inside, and also methamphetamine found inside the home. But y'all, that's only part of the story. So, okay, according to police records, Jason's body was discovered, and investigators believe that multiple people after that had helped Isabel Johnson avoid arrest. So police say that 63-year-old Martin and Sandra Leverton first became involved after Isabel contacted them while she was in Georgia, and she asked them to bail her out of jail on unrelated charges. Now, the couple drove to Georgia, picked her up, and brought both her and a white van back to Florida. So a few weeks later, after investigators searched the Sunset Lane property and discovered Jason's remains, Martin and Sandra allegedly learned that police were looking for Isabel. So according to the reports, Isabel admitted to them that she had killed Jason. So she's just walking all over town confessing this to everybody. Now, despite that, police say that the couple continued helping her evade law enforcement. Investigators allege that this couple hid Isabel, gave her a phone so she could stay in contact, tried to arrange transportation for her out of Florida, connected her with other people, who we'll get to in a minute, who might help her, and even suggested places where she could hide. Now, the arrest report also says that deleted text messages recovered by investigators show conversations between Sandra and Isabel discussing screenshots of text messages with Jason. And at one point, Sandra allegedly referenced using a zip tie, similar to the one that investigators believed was used in Jason's killing. Now, Sandra later told detectives that she was only joking about the zip tie. Now, last week, Martin and Sandra Lieberton were both arrested and charged with knowingly helping Isabel Johnson evade law enforcement. And the sheriff warned that anyone helping her will be arrested. Well, they made good on that promise because two more people have now also been arrested. Now, these are the people who Martin and Sandra tried to get her hooked up with to help. 74-year-old Michael White and 59-year-old Kathleen Morris have now also been arrested. Now, they are each charged with accessory after the fact to a capital felony and obstruction. And according to investigators, they knowingly allowed Isabel to stay at their home. They transported her, provided supplies, and lied to deputies about whether she had been there. Detectives also say text messages recovered from Kathleen's phone helped corroborate those allegations. Okay, so as for Isabel, y'all, she remains wanted, and this is where I need y'all's help. I live in the Panhandle, Florida, and I was born and raised in Georgia, so I know I have a ton of family and friends and followers in those areas. So y'all be on the lookout. Now, I've posted the pictures on my social media, and they are also on the Facebook page of Walton County Sheriff's Office, Florida. Investigators say that Isabel has used numerous aliases, including Harley, Jessica Elaine Bowman, Jessica Elaine Thrush, Jessica Dowdy, and others. She's described as 5'3" with brown hair and hazel eyes, but investigators say that she may have cut and dyed her hair to change her appearance. Now, the Walton County Sheriff's Office has also made it very clear. Anyone who knowingly helps Isabel Johnson avoid arrest could face criminal charges themselves. There is video of Isabel at a business in Destin, Florida last week, so y'all keep your eyes open. An $11,000 reward is now being offered for information leading to her arrest. And investigators believe that she has ties throughout Northwest Florida, South Georgia, and Lower Alabama. So if anyone has any information about where she may be, the Walton County Sheriff's Office is asking you to contact them or submit an anonymous tip through Emerald Coast Crime Stoppers. This investigation is still ongoing, and I have a feeling there's a lot more to come in this case. So I will give you updates on the next court report. But for the latest, you can follow my social media accounts on Instagram and Facebook. All right, so let's move on to the trials we are watching right now. There is a heartbreaking case out of Georgia that got underway this week. Kiana Davis, a former school teacher, is accused of murdering her 2-year-old son, Carter Ambrose, back in 2020. Now, prosecutors allege that Kiana and her boyfriend, Keon Benton, repeatedly abused Carter and then failed to get him medical care after he suffered catastrophic injuries. Kiana is charged with 7 felonies, including malice murder, felony murder, aggravated assault, and multiple counts of cruelty to children. Now, if she's convicted, she faces a potential life sentence. Both Kiana and her boyfriend, Keon, were indicted in 2023, and they have both pleaded not guilty. Now, Keon's case is still pending, and he will be tried separately. So if you haven't heard of this case before, it is an incredibly difficult one to listen to. On November 17th, 2020, little Carter was rushed into a pediatrician's office. He was wearing only a diaper and a t-shirt, and by the time he arrived, his pulse was fading, he was cold to the touch, and his eyes had rolled back into his head. Now, the medical staff desperately tried to save him, but they could not. So Carter did have a history of a few medical conditions like asthma, but the medical examiner determined that his death was actually caused by blunt force trauma to his abdomen that lacerated his liver. Investigators also documented injuries to his torso, head, and genital area. Now, according to prosecutors, those injuries occurred during a period when only Kiana Davis and Keon Benton had custody of Carter. And that's why the state argues that they are both legally responsible, even if investigators can't say beyond a doubt which one actually inflicted the fatal blows. Now, their argument is essentially that one adult caused the injuries while the other failed to protect him, making both criminally liable. The defense, however, says that Kiana never abused her son. And during the trial this week, she took the stand in her own defense and told jurors that Carter was never harmed in her presence and that she had never known her boyfriend to harm Carter either.
Was this child ever harmed or hurt or injured by you or in your presence? Now, Mr. Benton, from time to time, had been at your place and looked after Carter, is that correct?
Yes.
Your sworn testimony, has Mr. Benton ever done anything in your presence or to your knowledge where he would harm this child?
No.
Jurors also heard Kiana's recorded interview with investigators, and in that interview, she became emotional while explaining that Carter had been sick the weekend before he died, and she said that she had left for work the morning of November 17th and later received a call from Keon Benton telling her that he was taking Carter to the doctor. Now, this is one of those cases where the jury has an incredibly difficult job ahead of them. There's no dispute that this little boy died from horrific injuries. And the question becomes whether the prosecution has proven beyond a reasonable doubt that Kiana Davis is legally responsible for his death. And even if the jurors can't determine exactly who struck the fatal blows, they'll have to decide whether the evidence shows that she either participated in the abuse or failed to protect her son from it. I don't envy this jury at all, and I know that this has to be super emotional. But it gets a little bit weirder. Okay, so closing arguments were done on Wednesday, and that's when the case was handed over to the jury. And keep in mind, like I just said, I know that this is high emotional, but y'all, there has been some juror drama. So on Wednesday, the jury foreperson sent a note saying that one of the jurors was refusing to discuss the case and deliberate, which is kind of wild on its own, right? But then after that, the judge got another note from one of the jurors saying that she is being harassed by the foreperson about her vote. So crazy. So the judge decided to send everyone home and let them cool off. Now, Thursday is a scheduled day off for court, and then they return Friday to continue deliberating. So I should have an update on the verdict by next week's court report. We'll be right back.
Hey, it's Ryan Seacrest here, and I have discovered a fun new escape from the daily grind, Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has hundreds of social casino-style games that's all free to play anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. So get to chumbacasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 21 plus.
Let's move into some legal twists this week. And this one involves someone that many of you already know. Mandy Matney has actually been a guest here on 13th Juror, and I have also been a guest on one of her podcasts, Cup of Justice. Many of you probably heard of her first through her original podcast, Murdoch Murders, which is now called True Sunlight, where her reporting on the Alex Murdoch case helped bring national attention to the family's financial crimes and the civil litigation surrounding the 2019 boat crash that killed 19-year-old Mallory Beach. Well, this week, Mandy found herself on the other side of the courtroom. A South Carolina judge found Mandy in civil contempt after ruling that she willfully refused to comply with a subpoena ordering her to sit for a deposition in the long-running civil lawsuit against Parker's convenience stores. If you remember, Parker's is one of the defendants accused of illegally selling alcohol to underage Paul Murdoch before the boat crash that killed Mallory Beach. That civil case ultimately became one of the first places Alex Murdoch's finances began unraveling. Now, Mandy is not a defendant in that lawsuit. She was actually subpoenaed as a non-party witness. And according to the court, after multiple attempts to quash the subpoena failed, a judge ordered that she appear for a deposition within 14 days. Now, on the scheduled day, however, Mandy did not go to the location listed in the subpoena. Instead, she appeared by Zoom from her attorney's office in Bluffton while the attorneys waited for her at the original deposition site. Now, Mandy argued that she feared for her safety and believed that the deposition location posed security concerns because of ongoing harassment that she says she has experienced while covering the Murdoch cases. But in a 22-page order issued this week, Judge R. Keith Kelly rejected that argument, writing that there was no persuasive evidence that the attorneys were trying to harass or endanger her, and he concluded that there was clear and convincing evidence that her failure to appear at the notice location was a deliberate decision to disregard both the subpoena and a prior court order. Now, the judge also pointed to social media posts that Mandy made after the deposition was canceled, including pictures of her having lunch and celebrating with attorneys involved in the case, saying that those posts basically supported his conclusion that she intentionally chose not to comply with the court's order. So as a result, the judge found her in civil contempt and ordered her to pay $171,500 in attorney fees and costs. And that's a lot, but it is a significant reduction from the more than $310,000 that had originally been requested. And he imposed an additional $5,000 fine. Now, Mandy responded publicly after the ruling, saying that she wasn't angry about being found in contempt, but she called the financial sanctions unprecedented. She also criticized the South Carolina justice system, writing that she believes the ruling is punishment for her reporting and her criticism of the courts. So this story is almost certain to continue. And given the amount of money involved in Mandy's response to the ruling, I wouldn't be surprised if we see further legal challenges in the months ahead. All right, let's move into appeals because there's been another development in the case of Letitia Stock. Now, for those of you who have followed me for a while, you need no introduction to Letitia. She is the subject of my very first episodes of 13th Juror Podcast, and I have made it very clear that I am not a fan. She murdered her adorable 11-year-old stepson, Gannon Stock, and then proceeded to tell every wild, off-the-wall, nonsensical story that she could to try to get out of it before finally pleading not guilty by reason of insanity, then faking multiple personality disorder, allegedly. She went so far as to pretend to become a different person with a different accent in the interview, allegedly. And y'all, let me be clear. In my opinion, this heifer is nuts, but she's fully sane. And the jury saw it that way too, because she was convicted in May of 2023 for his murder, and also convicted of tampering with a deceased human body and tampering with physical evidence, because she put this child's body in a suitcase and drove him across country with her own daughter in the van with her before dumping his body in the suitcase over a bridge in Florida. And the entire time, she was fussing at her husband, Gannon's dad, for not having her back and not taking her side. So, she was convicted. But earlier this year, the Colorado Court of Appeals threw out those convictions. Now, this is not because they thought she was innocent or because they believed any of her harebrained stories, but because they ruled she did not receive a fair trial. Now, specifically, the appeals court said that the trial judge should have removed a prospective juror whose son-in-law worked in the same district attorney's office that was prosecuting the case. And because of that, the appeals court ordered that Letitia receive a new trial. Well, now the prosecution is fighting back. The Colorado Department of Law has filed an appeal with the Colorado Supreme Court asking the state's highest court to review that decision. So here's what that means in plain English. Letitia is not getting a new trial yet. The Supreme Court has to decide whether it even wants to hear the case. If the Supreme Court declines to take it, then the appeals court's ruling stands and Letitia would be entitled to a new trial. But if the Supreme Court agrees to hear the case and ultimately sides with prosecutors, her original murder convictions and life sentence could be reinstated. So for now, nothing has actually changed in terms of her case, but the prosecution is simply asking the Colorado Supreme Court to take another look before a new trial moves forward. I am all for all trials being fair. That is what I love. It is what I stand for. It is what I am all about. But I gotta be honest, it makes me so frustrated thinking that she could potentially put that family through another trial because I saw how hard that first one was. I just can't imagine. So I'll keep y'all updated on that one. We'll be right back.
Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. Victory Lane? Yeah, it's even better with Chumba by my side. Race to ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. CTNCs 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
All right, let's move into our cases making headlines. And one case that has been getting a lot of national attention is the death of 18-year-old Nolan Wells out of Mississippi. Now, if you haven't been following this one, Nolan was a college football player who traveled with a group of friends to Horn Island on the 4th of July. Now, authorities say that the group left the island by boat that afternoon, but Nolan did not return with them. According to the Jackson County Sheriff's Office, those that were with him said that Nolan chose to stay behind and planned to catch a ride back to the mainland with another group later that day. When he never made it home, his mother reported him missing. Now, 2 days later, search crews found Nolan's body in the water just off the northwest side of Horn Island. So here's what we know. The GPS data shows that the boat left the dock just before 10 a.m. and arrived to Horn Island at 11:14 a.m. Now, they were there pretty much all day, but the last time that Nolan was seen on the island was around 3 p.m. His friend said that Nolan didn't want to leave because he had met a girl, and he said he was just going to catch a ride back later on someone else's boat. But his family has questioned that account from the very beginning because they said that it would have been completely out of character for him to voluntarily stay behind. And they have actually hired civil rights attorney Ben Crump to conduct an independent investigation. Now, the boat left Horn Island at 4:31 p.m. and returned to the dock that it came from. That's according to the GPS. And there was apparently some kind of electrical issue, so they had to leave. GPS also shows that the boat then went to Fort Bayou around 5:52 p.m. and returned to the dock again 14 minutes later. And then a little over an hour after that, it went to the Fort Bayou boat launch where it was put on a trailer and towed to the home of the boat owner in Biloxi. And the boat's owner and his mom have cooperated with the investigation. Then there's the issue of Nolan's phone. Okay, so if you've heard of Snapchat Maps, you know that a lot of young people use that app to track locations. You can see where your friends are and it shows their location on a map, literally down to like the house that they're at. If you zoom in, you can see the house that they're at. It's actually kind of scary. So the mother of one of Nolan's friends used Snapchat to locate his phone, which was apparently at a house where a lot of people were gathered together. So she went to go get it, and she said that it took about 15 minutes for them to locate the phone and hand it over. Now, Nolan's mom then went through his phone looking for any kind of clues, right? Like, that's what a mom's going to do. They're going to try to find anything they can. So she went through looking for any kind of clues about what may have happened, but she thought that it was weird because she said that she thought that his phone seemed too clean. Like, there were no pictures or videos in Snapchat from the day that he was on the island. His mom said that he always had his phone out, and it's hard for her to believe that there was nothing there. So I totally understand what she's saying, but also I personally just don't want to speculate on this part of this too much yet. We have an island here in Panama City Beach called Shell Island, and it's kind of like how Horn Island is. It's protected. It has incredible untouched beaches, and there are tons of boats that will pull up and dock there for the day or for a few hours or whatever and just kind of enjoy the island and the clear water around it. And anytime we take a boat out to Shell Island, most of us generally leave our phones in the boat. The sand and the salt water can damage a phone really fast, and especially if it's hot and you're in the water the majority of the time, you just kind of keep the phones on the boat. So I don't want to jump right into speculating on this specific detail yet. But also, having the phone is going to be huge because they will be able to tell a lot by that download. Even if things were deleted from that phone, that's something that you'll be able to tell when the download is done. So we can probably expect to hear more on that at some point, I'm sure. I just don't want to speculate too much now. Now, when Nolan was found, there were no immediate signs of physical injury, according to the coroner, but they have done an autopsy to determine if there was any foul play or any trauma. Now, the family has also requested an independent autopsy to be performed because they felt like things just really weren't adding up, and they wanted a doctor who had no ties to Mississippi law enforcement. Now, there was also a video that has circulated widely from that day, and there was a lot of speculation about the voice in that video being Nolan's. The video captured the voice in a seemingly like really heated argument, but one of Nolan's friends has come forward and said that it was actually him, that he was the voice in that video, and he was the one in an argument. He said there was another man who was a stranger, he had never met him, who started a fight with him on the island. And he said that he was on the boat and his friends were trying to restrain him, and he was yelling at them to let him go so that he could go continue this fight with the stranger. So the friend also said that Nolan was very important to their group of friends. He described him as someone that you automatically felt comfortable to talk to, and he said that everybody admired Nolan. He was somebody who brought them all together. So, very sad story. Still a lot of questions. This is definitely one that we will continue to follow because it really does feel like every new piece of information answers one question while raising two more. All right, jurors. Our last topic to cover is cases to watch next week. And this is a big one. Jury selection is scheduled to begin Monday in the highly anticipated case of Commonwealth versus Lindsay Clancy out of Massachusetts. Now, if you have not followed this case, it is a tough one, y'all. Lindsay Clancy is a former labor and delivery nurse, and according to investigators, Lindsay asked her husband, Patrick, to pick up some takeout on the evening of January 24th, 2023. So he left to go get the food and came back about 25 minutes later. Now, when he got back home, he found that Lindsay had jumped from a second-story bedroom window, so he called 911. Now, he's on the phone with 911 dispatcher as he is walking through the house, and while on the phone, he discovers their three children inside the home with exercise bands wrapped around their necks. Five-year-old Cora and three-year-old Dawson were pronounced dead after arriving at the hospital. And Callan, who was only 8 months old, died several days later. I can't even say that without my stomach dropping. Prosecutors allege that after sending her husband out to pick up takeout, Lindsay used the exercise bands to strangle all three of the children before attempting to take her own life by jumping from that second story window, leaving her paralyzed. So she has pleaded not guilty to three counts of murder. Now, the facts of what happened that day are not expected to be the biggest issue at trial. Instead, this case is likely to center on Lindsay Clancy's mental state. The defense plans to argue that she was suffering from postpartum psychosis and should be found not guilty by reason of lack of criminal responsibility, which is Massachusetts' version of an insanity defense. Prosecutors, on the other hand, contend that the murders were intentional and planned, and they intend to prove that she was legally responsible for her actions. Now, there have already been several important rulings leading up to trial. Just this week, the judge denied the defense's request to allow other women who experienced postpartum depression or postpartum psychosis to testify about their own experiences. The judge ruled that those issues should instead be addressed through expert witnesses. Now, prosecutors have also dropped three separate strangulation charges, explaining that they were legally redundant because the alleged strangulations are already encompassed within the murder charges. The trial is expected to last 6 to 8 weeks and could feature more than 200 potential witnesses. Lindsay's husband, Patrick Clancy, is expected to testify for the defense. Now, Patrick has also filed a wrongful death lawsuit against some of Lindsay's healthcare providers, kind of on behalf of the estates of their three children. Now, this lawsuit alleges that in the months leading up to this tragedy, Lindsay had actually been prescribed at least 9 different psychiatric medications, and 8 of those were written just during a 3-week period in November to early December. And remember, this happened in January. So according to the complaint, those medications included Prozac, Remeron, Ambien, Lamictal, Valium, Seroquel, and Clonopin. Now, the lawsuit also says that Lindsay's mental health rapidly deteriorated despite repeated interactions with medical providers. And according to Patrick, Lindsay began hearing what he described as a compelling, unfamiliar male voice. And this voice that she was hearing was telling her that this was her last chance. And the lawsuit says that the voice convinced her that if she died, her children would suffer without her, and the only way to protect them was to take them with her. Now, Patrick says that these were all symptoms of severe postpartum psychosis and that it went unrecognized and untreated by her healthcare providers. So jury selection is set to begin Monday, July 20th. And because of the extraordinary publicity around this case, the court plans to seat 18 jurors, including 6 alternates, so that they can kind of ensure the trial will proceed without interruption. Now, no matter what side of this case you find yourself on, I think one thing is certain, and that is this trial is going to spark some incredibly difficult conversations. It raises questions about postpartum depression and postpartum psychosis and about how mental illness is recognized and treated. It also brings up conversations about the responsibility of healthcare providers and about where we draw the line between medical illness and criminal responsibility. And at the same time, it's impossible to lose sight of those 3 young children at the center of this case whose lives were cut tragically short. This is going to be a hard one. Over the next several weeks, jurors will not be asked to decide whether this is heartbreaking, because obviously we all agree that it is, but they will be asked to answer a much narrower legal question, and that's whether or not Lindsay was criminally responsible for her actions under Massachusetts law. It's a case that's certain to generate passion, debate, all of that long after the verdict is read. So we will be following this one every step on 13th Juror. All right, y'all, that's your court report for this week. I'll be back next week with the latest developments. Until then, keep asking questions, keep looking at the evidence, and decide for yourself what you believe. My name is Brandi Churchwell, creator and host of the 13th Juror podcast. If you enjoyed this episode, be sure to follow the show on your favorite podcast platform and leave a rating or review. It helps more listeners discover the podcast. And if you know someone who would find this case as fascinating as you did, share this episode with them. For additional episodes, case updates, and more information about the podcast, visit our website at 13thjurorpodcast.com. The evidence has been presented, the arguments have been made, and now comes the same question faced by every juror. What do you believe? Thank you for listening.
Hey, it's Ryan Seacrest here, and if you're looking for some serious fun, head over to ChumbaCasino.com. At Chumba Casino, you can play all your favorite social casino-style games for free anytime, anywhere. It's the most fun you can have on your phone or computer.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 21+.